Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million, didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
I'm talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Hello and welcome back to Sax and Jax. I'm Tom Allen. We got Andrew on the board on a Thursday. Shake up the lineup this week. We have Professor Lou. Professor Lou with us.
Hello.
Hey, how are you, bud?
There you are.
S&P futures up 4 and NASDAQ futures up 1, so slightly the upside here this morning. How are you?
Cold and snowy. We finally got some precip here in Denver.
Well, we are cold and snow here, and I'm not happy with it. It seems like my biological clock is a little off. It's a little early.
We had such a great run of gorgeous sunny weather where you could watch the sun come up and all that, and yesterday was dark and cold and reminded me of the solstice.
Yeah.
So it was, we got about, I mean, I at my house I think we got about almost 7 inches of snow up in the ski areas, since you're going to ask. They number of places got over a foot, and there's more coming. So I think Mother Nature's trying to make up for the deficit of snow that we've had so far in 1 or 2 weeks. So it's gonna, and I think you guys, we're not gonna get hit with this. I think we're gonna miss this, but I think you guys are looking at some major deep freeze here within the next couple of days, right?
Well, today is real cold. It's not like it can't, everybody complain, hey, it's November, December in Chicago. Well, yeah, it is. And we're certainly liable to get some snow, but you don't get the 32 degrees snow back down to 25, 2 days later repeat like it's January, February, like we did in the Bern Mayer year.
Yeah.
I mean, right now, it snowed 3 days ago in, essentially November, and it's still here. I mean, it's 11 out right now, which is pretty cold for this time of the year.
So I do not miss those days when I was living in Chicago and coming into the station, where I would walk to the train station, which was about, I don't know, 8-9 tenths of a mile away, in this kind of weather, and then walk from the train station on Adams Street to the studio, or the Stocks and Jocks World Headquarters.
Yeah.
And then back to my office. Those days I don't miss.
Well, when you come across the bridge, what do they call the wind? The hawk.
Yep. Or I mean, there were a couple of days when I did that in below zero weather, and I still tell a story about it.
Well, plus you always dressed like a lawyer.
Well, that's
was part of it.
The problem. That was part of the problem.
Yeah,
I distinctly recall walking. It was like 10 below zero, I think, and I was walking to the train station, and it felt like I had two pieces of tin pipe on my legs rather than pants.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the hairs on my legs were literally breaking off.
it comes in different times. I don't remember when I was working for Pullman downtown. I mean, that was late 70s. I mean, you wore a suit to work and you put a top coat. I mean, you wore your dress shoes, and maybe in the world's worst days you put a pair of rubbers over them. But like my mom was telling me, when she when she was young, she goes, you went to work dressed up. You were in your, no, nobody in those days dreamed of putting a a winter L.L. Bean shoe on with your shoes in your handbag. She goes, no, nobody would have ever done that and looked like that.
No, in fact, I had a. It's funny you would mention this. I had a court appearance yesterday, and I was walking because it was. It's a little ways away, so I was walking to the courthouse with one of our associates, and there was snow all over the place. They don't plow here in Denver, and they don't have the kind of requirements that shop owners clear the sidewalks in front of their places like they do in Chicago, or building owners. We're trudging away, and I said I used to have an entire wardrobe of quasi dressy stuff that would double as winter attire for example shoes. And I said I'm wearing one set of them today. They're basically half boots with a dress top on them, but with a lug sole on the bottom so that I can move through the snow. But they look like dress shoes.
They don't fall on your ass like an old guy.
That's right. So I had a super insulated long coat that went down almost all the way to my ankles, and you had, because you were out, if you were in Chicago, I tell people Chicago is a walking city. If you're working in downtown in the Loop, you're walking from the train station in the worst case I had a walk of a little over a mile to the office. And I did that, twice a day, every day. So you're outside 40 minutes.
If you're one of the real clever guys from the if you've got in the Northwestern station, now you came in Union Station, so you're pretty close, but if you came in Northwest Station, that's a hike.
Yep.
Well, now it's Ogilvy, but the guys from the SIBO, they would have probably six buildings that you could cut through.
Right. There was a whole cut through culture that you had marked, and I learned that early on. I was told by one of the other attorneys at the firm I was working at that, here are the routes, and this way you're not exposed to cold the entire way. You'd cut through lobbies, you'd cut through whatever, and then and sometimes you could actually down over by the Randolph station over there. There was an underground passageway that you could walk through. That was supposed to be a commercial district. What happened to that?
Oh, I don't know. The planning in Chicago was not so high. We did a seminar up in Toronto, and they have up there, you pretty much never have to go outside because the buildings have like bridges between them on like the first or second floor.
Minneapolis had the same setup in a portion of the downtown where you could walk between buildings because of the overstreet bridges.
We did a seminar up there, and I was representing the CBOE. Did you ever hear of the no weasel rule?
No.
Well, I don't know how many seminars you've done or big money shows or big finance shows where everybody's got booths and stuff, and the CBO would always have booths, and they had their marketing people there, and they were always real nice. I mean people I'd go with. And once in a while, they'd bring a member with or a member or two, because if they talked, the member could ask questions about trading and so forth. And I, since I was on the marketing committee, I became the favorite member there for a while. And whenever you're at one of these things, like a money show, there's all these breakout sessions where everybody goes.
Right.
And, then you're sitting there at the booth, like, basically with nothing to do. So people in the booths, basically BS with each other. And a lot of people, a lot of times, some of your people you're trying, you might want to sell to are people in other booths, right? Well, in Canada, they're really dead against that. You're there to get the people coming in. You're not supposed to talk with each other. So they actually pass out this thing with a weasel drawn on it. And at the top, it says the no weasel rule. And I'm going, these guys got to be kidding. So all of a sudden, there's this big breakout session. The guy across in the other booth comes over. He's BSing with me. And all of a sudden, the security guard shows up, and he says to this guy, hey, you see this no weasel rule? The guy goes, what are you talking about? You're not supposed to be over here. You're not a guest of the show. You're just a booth guy. You're not supposed to be over here bothering these guys. He's not bothering me. Still, we got this. The guy was serious about it. The only place I must have gone 100 of those things, the only time I ever heard of the no weasel rule was in Toronto.
No, I've never. I managed to miss that one. but
hey, I watched the high school game last night. Mount Carmel played Oswego for the 8A championships. What are they doing, these high school kids, Lou? They're so fat, it's scary, the linemen. They got to be 350. Looks like a pie eating contest, not a football. I mean, tell you what, they couldn't get moved.
Well, yeah. So I actually, that's become a thing in terms of getting guys to be gigantic. And in high school, I played, even when I was in high school, I played against two twins on a team, and these kids topped 260,
which is huge. If you're just regular
for a high school, yeah. for a high school player. So, you know, we're reading about these guys in the press and before we played them. And, you know, my father, again, the offensive line coach. So I was playing at about, I mean, in high school, I think I played a little over 200. And I was an offensive lineman and about 205 or whatever, and that was a pretty good size for 210, a pretty good size for a high school offensive lineman back then. And I'm just thinking, how am I going to block a guy that, you know, outweighs me by 50-60 pounds? And, you know, my father just said, take a look at these guys. He goes, unless they're really special, they're going to be really overweight and they're not going to be mobile, and you're going to be able to, you may not be able to move them very far, but you're going to be able to take them out of the play. And he was exactly right. They were these two great big fat guys, and they could barely get down in a stance, and their job was basically to sit in the middle and just clog things up. And I mean, that was great. All you had to do was basically stand up and lean on them.
Well, have you noticed the style though? There's a clothing style for this now. If you're the team I'm talking about is Mount Carmel. Their colors are brown and white, right? So, but everybody wears, it was cold, so everybody's got this white, essentially undershirt on, probably a thermal shirt of some kind. And if you're a big fatso, the brown shirt doesn't come down and be tucked in. You don't even attempt to do that. It stops like right above where your belly starts. So you got like this little tube on top where it's barely got the number on it, and everybody's gut is sticking out in the white shirt. If you're too fat, I'm like, there's a look.
I don't get that. But
can't you make a jersey big enough for the guy?
good for them. I think I told you, but I've said several times on the show, for offensive linemen, my father's theory, and you're actually seeing more of this if you look at the blocking patterns that you see on. And by the way, as I think of it, let me congratulate the Chicago Bears for getting an offensive line that can actually run block well. And is taking it to the defenses that they're playing. That game the other week, I don't care how good or bad old Caleb is. I think he's a terrific athlete, but I don't know how much of an NFL quarterback he is. But if you can run the ball like you guys are running the ball right now, it doesn't matter. I'm impressed.
Well, I seem to be. I mean, this is weird because I want to talk a lot about football with you today. One is obviously the Mississippi deal, Ole Miss, and the other is the NIL for high school kids in Ohio. But
yeah.
I look at the Bears, and I had them losing a bunch of games, and obviously they're doing a lot better than that, so wrong all. They put an offensive line together in the offseason. They managed to find a left tackle that they had drafted, I think, out of Canada or someplace.
Yep, I think so.
And
CFL guy.
But you look at all these other teams, every other team, their offensive line is decimated. It seems like out of all the parts in football, you know, you can't have three quarterbacks, but most teams have a bunch of ends. They got a few guys that can run the ball if there's a hole. But most teams, as you go from 14 to 16 to 17, soon to be, I guess, 18 games, the people you sort of can't replace are the offensive line. Like, nobody has 10 offensive linemen that are good enough to play, it seems. And if those guys don't stay together as a unit, I don't care who you are. Look what's happened to Buffalo.
Yep.
The guy's getting sacked. Every other team you look at seems to have one or two or three offensive linemen out. The guy in Green Bay last week, somebody fell on the back of his leg, and he's out for the year. The Bears managed. They have to be the only unit that has started every game.
Well, and you, I think I've said this before, offensive line play, and again, I draw back on my father who coached in the NFL for, you know, a quarter century. Offensive line play is a dance. It's like a ballet, and your footwork, your timing, your movement is all keyed not just on what you're supposed to be doing on a set play, but on what the guys around you are supposed to be doing. And you develop, and it's if you've done it, if you've done it for a little while, you pick this up very, very quickly. It's absolutely essential that you synchronize and be in synchronization with the people around you in terms of how you move, in terms of how you put your feet, in terms of where you think somebody's going to be on a set play, because you're constantly, as part of this dance, you know, you're dancing with in a formation with a bunch of four other guys or five other guys sometimes, but you've got people who are trying to break the dance up and interrupt the dance, and you have to know where your guys are going to be with respect to your opponents in a certain play. So if you're double teaming, and you see a lot of this now, they're called combo blocks or slide blocks. You'll see a double team where two linemen will go on one defender and drive him back, and then one of them will slide off to pick up somebody else once they've got control of the defensive lineman.
You see that in the guard play now.
Tight end tackle, but you'll see them slide off. That is a idiosyncratic play, and you have to have a sense of what the guy next to you is doing and when he's got control of the player that you're double teaming so that you can slide and make that slide. And that is an individual.
Well, that's what the two guys from the two guys from Notre Dame were notable as. Zach Martin in Dallas and the guy on Nelson on Indy. The guy, and we listen to a lot. I'm always driving during the Notre Dame game, right? So the guy who's doing the play-by-play, but the color guy on the radio is really good. This guy, Ryan Harris, is a tackle. He played it under Charlie Weiss, and he won a Super Bowl in Denver. I guess he was with Peyton Manning. But he really knows his line play. I mean, so do you, obviously. But what he's talking about is when you see a guard in college that can do that and get to the second level and essentially mm-hmm. make two, yep. two blocks on one play, he goes, that guy's playing on Sunday.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's – but you need to have – for it to be really effective, you need to have cohesion and you need to have experience. And if guys are – if you can't put a consistent line together – my father's made one comment to me one time. The Vikings had an 8-8 year or something, or a 7-8 year sorry, 7-7 year, something like that. One of their unsuccessful years when he was there. And he was talking to one of the other coaches with some party over at our house, and that coach said, you did the best job of coaching in your life this year because you've never had the same line together 2 weeks in a row, and we managed to win seven games with basically zero cohesion on the offensive line. Our offense was you know, decimated, and yet you guys were able to put together a string of seven victories, which, you know, frankly, we should never have.
Well, if you haven't played sports, I mean, you've played obviously at a higher level than I did, but even in softball, if you get a group of guys together and all of a sudden everybody plays the same position in the right spot for them every week and is there every game, the team just gets better as the year goes on.
Yep.
You look at the back at the Bears in the 80s, and obviously Jimbo Covert just made it to the Hall of Fame, but they had probably one of the best. I don't know how good those guys were, but I'm going to say over a 4-year period when they were a dominant team, I don't think anybody missed a start. I think they ever played. I don't think he ever missed a game. I don't think it was the big right tackle, Keith Van Horn. I don't think Bortz ever did. The center might have, but they were together every game. I mean, I got to believe even if you're not the best, you're going to get pretty good.
Yeah, and again, if you're next to really good people, and you can work well with them, you know, you're gonna shine. So I just wanted to say it was a pleasure watching that the highlights of that game last week because I
well look how good watched, the, look I, how good the halfback is and don't even know who the hell he was. That's
exactly right. And you know this is the point that you make with how key offensive line play is. A really good offensive line makes your quarterback better. It makes your running backs better. It makes the offense look much better than it probably would be if you just took the individual players and put them out by themselves.
I can't believe that there's a back in all the NFL that if he doesn't get touched to 3 yards downfield, isn't going to look pretty good. I mean, he's in the NFL for
exactly
guys.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
Hey, what is going on with the NIL in Ohio? And you got to talk to us a little bit about this LSU situation. What is with this SEC? Are they going bonkers? Are the alumni taking steroids or what?
So the NIL in Ohio is the result of a high, and we're talking about high school.
Yeah, high school.
So what happened was a player, some kid from a high school in Ohio, apparently got offered a sponsorship deal, and this is one of the scourges of social media is that it has elevated visibility for athletes way past just pro in college. It's now reaching down into high school. And to a certain extent, some sports have always been like this. For example, basketball. You know, you had shoe companies going to, you know, ninth and tenth graders and the posse that surrounded them and reaching out to them and saying, hey kid, you know, where are our shoes, here's some money, whatever. All of this was in complete violation of every high school amateur rule that I was aware of.
Okay, but back, if you don't mind, sorry to interrupt, but back up a second because I was just with him last night. We were talking about sort of the same thing. My attorney friend Bill, who you'd love to meet, his daughters were on a state championship team at Loyola. His one daughter was the leading scorer at Loyola up to like last year. Anyway.
But, for hoops? Or?
Oh, yeah, hoops. One of them has had her number retired in three different sports at Loyola, track, volleyball, and hoops. Or so. Anyway, but he said that all that money was always funneled. The high school, even though it was a great thing, all the playing was done with the AAU?
Yes.
And the money came through the AAU.
Money came through AAU or the whatever Olympic sport organization that was looking for these kids. But yes, the AAU basketball basically took over for high school basketball in a number of areas.
Well, because he said she was Loyola was ranked number two in the country, and some school in Oregon was ranked number one for ladies high school basketball. He said on her AAU team, the AAU guy kind of put the team back together, and up in some tournament in Minnesota, they played the Oregon team in the summer.
Yep.
I mean, I had no idea. I mean, obviously, if you played, on the South Side, you played football, basketball. I didn't know of any of that stuff. I didn't even know who the AAU was, other than way back in the day when I was a kid, they used to fight with the NCAA over Olympic stuff. I thought they were dead and buried, but then obviously they're not.
Yeah. So high school sports have always been amateur, and they've been very rigorous in protecting that amateur status. Well, in Ohio. Some kid was pretty good, and somebody was even football, I think, and they wanted some sponsor, some company wanted to pay him to sponsor or wear clothes or some activity, but he was going to get money for his athletic status. That was a violation of the Ohio High School League rules, and this kid's mother filed a lawsuit to break that down, and the Ohio Supreme Court said you can't restrict a high school athlete's ability to get name, image, likeness payments, and accordingly, they high school league said, all right, fine, we'll try to figure this out, but as of right now, you can get quote NIL money, name, image, and likeness money for high school athletes. Now. The question is how does this get regulated? I dug back in in the off week over Thanksgiving, I dug back into the House settlement and the of the NCAA case just to make sure I had my arms around the rules. So in college, the Big Five conferences that signed on as participants in the NIL settlement that was this case called House versus the NCAA, they've capped NIL payments that are coming from colleges. Colleges can make NIL payments to the athletes, but it's capped. Every other NIL deal that comes in from third parties is going to be reviewed by this NIL committee that's been set up as a result of the settlement to make sure that these are legitimate deals and not just pay for play. And that goes for any deal over $600.
Who are these guys? Who's going to guard the guards?
Well, oh come on, they're lawyers. They're honest. I'm not joking. That's the thought process. This committee that's been set up, and of course, the law firms that orchestrated the settlements are going to be major players in these oversight.
Yeah, I'm shocked and appalled.
Shocked and appalled. And of course there'll be a small professional service charge to participate or to be on that committee, I'm sure. In any event, so effectively what they're trying to set up in the NCAA is something that looks very much like the NFL salary cap system. They're trying to restrict money that are coming from the schools to the players, and doing it in such a way that it doesn't trigger the requirements of Title IX and it doesn't violate antitrust law, and they're,
well, they, good luck on all that, because it violates all that stuff.
It theoretically does, but again, because it's pursued as part of a settlement, the court has blessed it and said you guys have got some protection. It may still get shut down for an antitrust violation. We'll just have to see. What all of this is driving and driving towards, I think, is some kind of national system in terms of federal law that will lay out the payment requirements and things like this. Because
why aren't we anxious to make another cartel when we already have the NFL?
Because there's so much money in it, Tom.
Well, but I mean,
there is so much money.
Okay, but I mean,
that's why it's these tentacles are reaching down into high school now.
Well, here's the Supreme Court thing, which I read a little bit of, not like you read them, but so we're going to have somebody go out there and get a thing with Under Armour, and they're going to be on two or three commercials, and you're going to have a bunch of attorneys saying, "Oh no, that's too much money. You're really getting paid to play at a school." Well, duh. I mean, what are they going to opine on? How much? How do they know how much it's worth marketing for somebody else?
Well, I agree. Well, I think the thought process will be: did the kid actually show up for a card signing, or did he show up for whatever, or is the wearing of a logo for a particular shoe company equal to $30 million or whatever he's going to get paid? That's the kind of assessment they're talking about. But you and I look at this from the perspective of economics and say the value is whatever somebody's willing to pay him, and that's whether it's
it sort of is. Some people have this amazing thing about their male appendage and whether a college team wins. I don't know what that's all about, but
I agree, but in any event, that's the system. So now in Ohio, do you have to set up something comparable?
Well, it's high school. I mean, the lady on the Notre Dame basketball team, Hannah Hidalgo, she gets this huge deal with Red Bull. So some lawyer is going to say, I don't think she's that good looking at all. She doesn't deserve $200,000. She deserves $10,000. Well, how's that going to work?
I don't know, and that's you're gonna trigger. I just see this whole system as unless they throw some other kind of protection around it, like a union, and that's another direction this thing seems to be moving in. I don't see how you don't just end up with a never ending wave of litigation.
Well, the Supreme Court pretty much. I mean, how do you try and stop the kids when you see what's going on at LSU? They got some bozo down there. They took him from Notre Dame, thank God. He's getting paid $8 million a year for 8 years, which no pro team would ever do. And then all of a sudden, the guy gets bleep canned. And what do you think they do? They bring in another guy, $10 million for 10 years. I mean, duh. What are you going to do to teach somebody? How many times has a kid got to touch the stove before he stays away from it?
They've opened up a can of worms on this. Again, this is going to happen. There's going to have to be some kind of quasi NFL like restriction, and House does that. So, for example, you know, there are roster restrictions now on these revenue sports within the House settlement. You're going to have fixed roster sizes. You can't have people on the periphery of your program. Everybody's got to be accounted for.
That makes sense.
They're gonna restrict that. As I said, the money that goes to these kids is going to be restricted. That gets paid from the college. Right,
you mind if I back up a second there?
Sure.
Because what the normal way to do this back in the day, not that long ago, is you get a school like Notre Dame, anybody. The deal was when I was there, you could give out like 30 scholarships a year. Well, 30 times 4 is 120, but you can only have 100, say 100 people on scholarship at the same time. So,
right.
And if somebody got on the team, you could have people that actually got a academic scholarship and they could play football. But
right.
but basically, you had the limit for the amount of people on the team or the amount of scholarships you gave out. But now that people are getting money other places, if somebody gets $1 million from Under Armour, they go, screw it, I'll just pay my own tuition. And I'll be on the team. And then they say, wait a minute. We don't want people. The amount of scholarships essentially was a roster limit to a certain extent. But then you had a bunch of guys that could walk on, guys like, you know, Rudy and stuff. But they never really played. But and you couldn't
do that anymore.
Now you can't. Well, you can, but you got to be counted.
It's a zero sum game. For every guy that walks on that you want to have on the field, you got to kick somebody else off.
Right. So theoretically, you could have 80 guys all making so much money they're paying their own tuition or isn't even a scholarship. You could have.
Well, yeah, theoretically,
yeah.
But that would, again, those 80 guys are counted.
Right.
You know, whether they're paying their own way or they're getting a scholarship, they're going to count against your roster limit.
But the roster limit are people that can suit up on Saturday. It's not how many people you have in practice, right?
No, it's how many people you've got on the team. You got to account for everybody that's on your team.
Okay, so I can't walk on.
You can, but you're gonna bump somebody off.
All right.
So it's a very pro style kind of arrangement, and I think, like I said, I think we're driving in a couple of directions. One is potential unionization of the athletes. Because once they put the union in place, they can do some other things with respect to antitrust that you simply can't. If these
guys, you get some dumb union to agree to it, then you're okay.
I think that's right. Another direction that it's driving or that it's being driven is in private equity investment. I think it's not going to be too long before you see. We've already seen some glimmerings of this, where you've got investment. Private equity investment groups that are going to band together, and they're going to go to like the SEC, and they're going to say, tell the SEC, we'll take your football program off your hands. We're going to give each school $150, $200 million, regardless of whether they win or lose. We're going to run we'll run the league. We know how to make it profitable. We know how to manage money. We know how to manage salary caps and things like this, stuff that your athletic directors aren't good at. We're real good at. We'll pay everybody this set amount, and if you come in with us, it's a guaranteed revenue for all the schools that come in under our umbrella, and we'll organize the playoffs, and we'll set up the national championship, and we'll manage all the sponsorship and the NIL deals, and you know, your kids will be, you know, they'll be enriched. The school will make mega bucks, and we won't have a bunch of guys who don't know what they're doing trying to manage a multi-billion dollar operation.
When do you lose your tax exempt at this point? You got to lose it there.
I would think you're getting real close, and at some point, Tom, don't we just say, you know, this whole scholar athlete thing is an anachronism. We really don't need these kids to go to class anymore. They can be affiliated with the school.
I agree.
They just don't have to be students.
You think they really are with four schools in 4 years? Good Lord.
Well, I mean, it was one of these things when I was an agent. I mean, I would talk to my guys, the kids I was representing, and I mean, I only had a couple of guys that were really high draft picks, but I would tell all of them, you know, the minute they got drafted, the minute they got signed, they would stop going to class. And I would say, you know what, if you were Walter Payton, I'd tell you that's a smart move, but otherwise I'm going to tell you to stay, get your degree, finish that so you got something when this ends. And I said, I know it doesn't seem like it's going to end right now, but it will. And for you, it's likely to end sooner rather than later. So stay in school, get the degree so you got something. Almost none of them did it. I mean, the pressure was just too great.
I don't understand that, because if you, I mean, I
would, and the NFL doesn't care.
No, they don't care. But I just, it's a weird thing when I, you know, some friends of mine have had kids that you know, kind of they like to cut class, and on a practical matter, I never did. A, because if you went, I pretty much enjoyed most of my professors actually. But if I didn't, what do I do all day? Everybody else goes to class, and I sit there doing what? Watching TV?
Play Call of Duty.
I mean, you know, it's weird to see everybody else marching off to class, and you're sitting there. It's like, I mean, it's an odd deal. I mean, it's like everybody going to football practice, and you stay at home cutting football prep. I mean, what are you doing? Well, you don't really talk to.
They go to the gym. They get the diet. The dietitian. They adjust their eating. They work out. They train. I mean, there are lots of things you can do to fill that time. But. I think we are rapidly moving in again, without some federal regulation, the market is going to drive this. We are rapidly moving to a place where the recognition of how much money can be made on this is not lost on a,
well, do you think
investor
it,
groups.
Do you think it's unlimited? There's been all kinds of places in the last 100 years that thought they had the world by the tail. Boxing did, bowling did, for God's sake. I mean, baseball to a huge extent did. And I don't, I don't know that this. There's got to be a limit to something. To how many, you know, to how many. Every time you go to watch your team, you got to get another service because they're making a few bucks there. You know, the tickets are, by the way, they're $150 now, and then the game starts at 9 o'clock at night and it's free. I mean, there's got to be some sort of natural limit to how far you can push people on this, I think. I know that, you know, my buddies are pretty rabid about Notre Dame, but most of them would say, you know, if it gets much more like this, I don't know, it looks like I'm watching a pro team to me. And they're trying to stay somewhere in the middle. Whether they're going to do that or not, I have no idea. But, I mean, you can't say to, I mean, my nephew was arguing with me last week about scholarships is a lot of money. I go, Tim, the coach is making... When scholarship was a lot of money when a coach was making $40,000. Now a coach is making $10 million. There's obviously some scratch around for everybody. It's got to make a way to the guys that are actually getting their head beat in at some point, you would think. I mean, I don't know where. I mean, Lou, we talk about you. You know, listen every day. I know you got better stuff to do, but it's almost like everything you and I have sort of known in life needs to be redefined. I mean, you look at the city of Chicago. That is broke, basically, and we're arguing over head taxes and God knows what. And this mayor, you know, I don't know how the hell he got to be mayor. I have no idea. Well, he got votes, I guess, but everything. I mean, if I were to walk in, I was saying this to Larissa yesterday. What if I walked into your class and I walked up to the blackboard, which really shows my age, saying that, and wrote up there, define profit for me. I don't. Can anybody define it today? You ever know, I mean, does anybody even know?
Well, I think your private equity guys can define it.
Well, I'm saying when I talk about the city of Chicago, probably the, you know, I don't know this for sure, one of the biggest cash generators in this whole downtown area has to be Northwestern Hospital. And everybody there makes a friggin' fortune. The bills that people pay to go there are to the roof. They're non-competitive. How the hell is that place not pay property taxes when the chairman's going to make $80 million? Or that's probably an exaggeration. Tell me that's not profit. That you couldn't go out and hire a guy for $2 million Anything over that to me is profit. The same way at Commonwealth Edison. If lose the chief attorney there, and he's making $20 million, and I can put out, I'm going to show my age, an ad in the Wall Street Journal tomorrow and get 15 other guys like Lou willing to work for $3 million, I'm going to say the other 12 is profit. It's just defined differently, isn't it?
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, I don't have any problem with those definitions.
I'm saying, but it used to be people working competitively, having competitive wages, spitting out money to investors, and that's considered profit. Well, why would any of these people ever have an investor? You think Commonwealth Edison gives a rat's ass about their investors? And Northwestern doesn't have any, but they sure act like they do, don't they? They're just nobody on the other end to spit it out. Same way with the Texas football program. Everything is there except, you know, wait a minute, who's the investor here? And, you know, and the other part is, talk about the tail wagging the dog. The revenue at, I'm going to say, it weren't even on my list yesterday. I had the college list here. I'm going to say the revenue for UCLA football is $150 million, which to you and I, maybe not to you, is a lot of dough. The budget for the school is $11 billion. How do they even get a spot in the board of directors meeting, for God's sake, in terms of actually what a school of that size does? I mean, I understand they don't want to bleep can their football team and alumni like and all that. I get that, but what are we doing here? We're willing to toss away the entire, you know, tax status of the school because of a football team?
I think it goes down to, and I hearken back to my youth at Duke, and I watched that program. I mean, when I was there as a law student, you know, Krzyzewski was just starting to make inroads into his program. People had been calling for his job the second year I was there, that he didn't know how to coach. And, you know,
Robert, who was there before him? Was the guy before him good too?
They had a pretty good program. Bill Self, I think it was the coach there before him, and he, I think he went to South Carolina, and he'd done a reasonably good job, but had a couple of lousy recruiting years, and so the program was sort of, you know, mid to lower tier ACC, and in the 80s the ACC was probably one of the premier conferences, if not the premier conference. So Krzyzewski rebuilds this program, and you could start to see it as I was, I guess, in the middle of my second year there. You could start to see some improvement, and then my third year there, they really started coming on like gangbusters. And what happened at Duke was this huge national flood of interest. First of all, their applications skyrocketed. Second thing that happened was they started getting money just pouring in from alumni to support the school, because the basketball program suddenly had this huge amount of visibility. And the rest of, I mean, I think college administrators sort of always knew this, but this was my first exposure to it. And, you know, the rest of the country looks around, and everybody, these other athletic directors look around, and the school presidents come to them and say, we need a winning program. If we can get a winning program, it opens up the door for us for fundraising. It opens up the door for donations. It opens up the door for our recruiting, for students. It has this ripple effect that cuts through the entire campus. So you've got to get us a coach that's going to turn this program around. And we'll do, I don't want to know the details, but you do what you think you need to do to get this program turned around.
And I always take the other side of this argument.
I know, but that's, I think that's what's happening.
I'm not supposed to agree with you, but I'm going to agree with you that in terms of that kind of fervor, in terms of people going back to Notre Dame and buying all kinds of crap from the bookstore and getting their weekend, there are three Supreme Court justices were there 2 weeks ago, conservative ones. How come you weren't invited?
Was Barrett there?
She was there, and so was Alito, and evidently Kavanaugh has a sophomore son there, or daughter. So the three of them were there.
Well, you know, that's... They're all Catholics, right? I think they're all Catholics. Those are all Catholic judges, so yeah, it makes sense.
I don't understand where the invitation to Lou in the skybox... I don't think they were sitting out with the great unwashed. That's just an offhand opinion, but My guess is they were in a skybox, and you weren't there.
No. Well, you know, my my cachet is not what it used to be.
Neither. None of us. But you know, well, my point is, I actually, since I was jousting with you on this a couple of years ago, I remember, you know, I sit there and go, well, I'm arguing with poor Lou, and he's usually always right, but I'm gonna dig into this one. And at this time, Indiana pretty much sucked, right? It was long before they had a decent football team. And I know that to get the group to come back to Notre Dame every year for the weekend and how much money people spend, and you send them a couple hundred bucks so you can be in the ticket pool and all that kind of crap, it brings some money to it. But if you went, I went back to Indiana, they had had two or three years in a row when their football team was horrible, their best years ever in terms of money for the place. And the money had nothing to do with athletics. Somebody gave them, you know, $1 billion for some medical school. Somebody gave them something else for the new, what's the name of the school that Russell works for, a new building for the business school. And all that money had nothing to do with athletics, the big dough. I mean, you know, would they have liked the football team like they do now and get kind of the other stuff as well? The answer is yes. But it really doesn't, it didn't seem to affect, you know, the life-changing stuff where guys are the new medical building or something. I mean, that guy didn't do it because the football team won. So it depends. You're right up to a point, I guess, what I'm saying, and so am I. I mean,
well, I agree that you know, the donors, there's going to be an element of donorship that's always there, but the emotional positives from a winning athletic program, and I let me just give you an example. So I fly into Chicago or going through Chicago for something a couple of months ago. I wasn't there long enough to swing by the studio, otherwise I would have said hello. And the airport was Midway. I flew in Midway. I've traveled through Midway. The airport was absolutely jammed. It was a Friday, and there were millions, it seemed like, thousands of Texans. Yeah. Because Notre Dame was playing Texas A&M.
Yep.
And I looked outside. The lines to get to the rental car buses went back like 100 yards. There were just, oh, there's people swarming.
There's people that travel and all this. I'm taking your side of the argument. Last year,
think of the economic impact of that.
Well, it's also a feel good thing. Of course, it is.
That's what I mean. The emotional positive.
Well, when the Irish were playing Indiana last year and then the playoff game, we went to our saloon over here to the series. We were surrounded by tables of people from Indiana. Lou, I never met nicer people in my life. I talked to everybody. Can you imagine that, me talking to everybody? They were just dying to be in there. It was the first time they'd ever done anything. They felt like I felt when I was a freshman and went down to see the Irish play Texas in the Cotton Bowl. It's an absolute rush. It's terrific. I agree. I mean, but the idea that Indiana can't survive without, nobody will give them a dime if the team doesn't win. I'm not there either. I mean,
but it makes a huge difference.
It's a reason to get together.
These things draw on basic tribal, you know, our basic tribal instincts.
Plus, people want to get together anyway, Lou. So, I mean, if the Irish were playing somebody in Denver, I'd go out there just because I'd go to the game with you. But we'd use that as an excuse to go.
I was in London when the Broncos were playing. I think the Jets, and the NFL has really capitalized on this well, because London, you could not walk around in the major parts of London without seeing somebody either in a Broncos jersey or a Jets jersey. I've never seen so much NFL presence in my life. There were, I think, 20 or 30,000 people from Denver and a comparable number from New York that flew to London just to watch the game.
Well, that's a lot of plane loads.
Yeah, it was. The planes were packed.
Why didn't those guys get the Queen Mary 2 and just go over on that?
Well, maybe that would require a little too much forethought for Jets fans. But in any event, my point is, if you can hold this up, the draw that is these football programs, you can hold this up to London, to Madrid, to Berlin, to Tokyo, and say, we're going to guarantee 40 or 50 million in profit, in revenue, that's going to come into you right now for this one weekend. If you just sponsor this one game, it's one of these deals, you know, where everybody's going to win.
Yeah, well, we're kind of out of time, but I want to ask you, what about the story on this Ole Miss? The guy's taken what, three assistants, and he's taken the general manager too?
Yeah.
What in that contract? Ties him to LSU where he can't go? What ties him to LSU that he can't leave after 2 years? What's the buyout clause on the other side?
It's a question. The question I had, and I haven't. So some full disclosure, I my family. Monty Kiffin coached with my dad for a while with the Vikings. So Lane, we know. I know Lane, but I only know him as a little kid. My sister babysat him.
Oh God.
So I'm not
so sure she wants to tell that at the polite society.
So full disclosure. I don't know. I don't know. I think if you want him badly enough or you want this guy badly enough, You don't put those escape clauses in his contract. He obviously didn't have one. Otherwise, Mississippi would have been able to tie him down.
How many more years did he have on their contract?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know what the.
I don't think it was very long.
No, but still, it the idea that you can waltz out of there with doing this kind of damage to the program, but. You know, this is the you make a bargain. You make these kinds of devil's bargains with people who are really good, and it's, you know, how you got them is how you're gonna lose them.
It almost two things. And then we got to go to our guys, but one is there's now five coaches that are promising a national championship. Well, last time I checked, there's only one of those. So assuming one of the five gets there, that you're gonna leave four people disappointed. The other question is, when he had the conversation with LSU, how much of it, and I'm not saying because you know the guy, how much of it was, how much is he going to get, or how much of it are they going to provide him to pay players? That had to be a huge part of the conversation.
Oh, you know it was. You know it was. I don't know. Yeah, who knows? Who knows what kind of...
I got Ole Miss at slightly different, slightly lower revenue than LSU, but they're not that much different.
No, I would suspect... They came to him with a financial package that included NIL, a bundle of NIL money, his compensation for his assistants, practice facility, the whole deal. So,
well, if you're sitting, imagine you and I sitting on the same board. How could the same board appoint both of us? They walk in, and one of us would have to say, "Wait a minute. We're paying one bozo $8 million a year for 8 years, and now he's gone. We got to pay him." Now, instead of saying that was a pretty stupid idea, we're gonna double up on the next guy. You and I would have to sit there and go, "Did you guys think this through?" I would think, wouldn't we?
Well, but this goes back, and I'm gonna let you go at this with this comment. This goes back to the emotional high that you get from this kind of a transaction, this kind of an expectation, and this kind of a program.
People start thinking
with that emotional high, and away you go.
How many people
here in Denver with Russell Wilson?
How many people? I'm going to say none. Think like me. I didn't play like you did, but I thought it was absolutely spectacular on a Saturday. I could walk across this kind of not crummy, beautiful campus, but small campus in South Bend, and see a major football team, and actually know some of the guys on the team. I thought it was absolutely spectacular, but I also learned no matter whether they won or lost, I still had my paper, still was due on Monday, and by the way, nothing changed on me. I have a different view of this. I mean, if you're going to do something, I like to see my team do well, but not to the point where these guys take it. What do they get out of this?
Yeah.
I don't get it. I mean, what does some guy who's, unless he's, you know, got a hot dog stand at the LSU Stadium, what does he really care whether they're 0-10 or 10-0? I mean, you care because you like the people, but realistically, do I really care if the Bears win? I mean, I like to see them win, but it's not like there's no we in McCaskey that I found.
Right.
Anyway, so Lou, thank you. Have a nice weekend. Are the guys here, Andrew?
Yeah.
You're here.
We are here.
What do you think of that discussion? You guys are kind of sports mavens. What do you think of all this?
Oh, I heard Ole Miss,
and that's actually my alma mater.
You didn't go to LSU, did you?
No, Ole Miss.
Really? So you can't be too happy with this.
I wasn't happy with all this when I was there.
Oh, God. How did you...
For other reasons.
All right, Andrew, how the hell did Wayne end up at Ole Miss?
Oh, he'll tell the story, but first I got to applaud your discussion, particularly at the end. I thought you had a great point, counterpoint, with Lou talking about the emotion, which I think is a big factor. But then you have the common sense view, which is another factor. And basically, yeah, I've been following those coaching situations too. And I mean, to take it to the pro level, I look at what the Boston Celtics have done. They had to cut salary, and everybody thought they'd end up at the bottom of the East in the NBA because they lost four top players from their team. And yet they tapped into the emotion and common sense and just beat the Pistons and the Knicks. So it's fascinating, which is why we're talking about it, but it is that mix of emotion and common sense that people got to figure out.
Well, I suspect, even though we've never gone through your history a huge amount, but you did a lot of athletics in your day, and it's there's a lot of vibes to that you don't quite get. Sometimes, you know, some players are so good that when you lose a guy like Tatum, it kind of screws your whole year. But there's also people that maybe they're not as good, but if a couple of them get in the game and all of a sudden, after 10 or 15 games, they learn to play with each other a little better, instead of a 4 on a scale of 1 to 10, they become a 6. They're not going to become a 10. And all of a sudden, you have 3 or 4 6s playing together, and guess what? You can put up a pretty good game. I mean, you always need the one guy who's a star, but you also need people that are improving that maybe don't get a chance, too. I mean, you never really know, do you?
Well, exactly. I had the opportunity to be a newspaper reporter covering the NBA for a year, mostly the Celtics and the Knicks. And I learned a lot from that experience. And one great thing I can recommend is a book called MBA by Red Auerbach, who I got to know a little bit. And MBA stands for Management by Auerbach. And one of his themes is you hire people with good character who are literally team players. And so what the Celtics, and there are others who are doing this, but to stick with the Celtics, they're getting people 28th pick in the draft. Peyton Pritchard, and he just scored 41 points. They got... undrafted people. They got people drafted at 35 or so who are stepping up because they identified these guys want to play. They have the basic tools. Let's teach them and keep them hungry because we can't afford the $20 million guys at this position.
Well, you're also talking about the 28th best player in the country, probably still pretty good.
Oh, yeah. In fact, a quick funny story. Wayne's had an eventful week, so I'll turn it over after this. But there's a former NBA player named Scalabrine, who's now an announcer for the Celtics, and he got tired of people saying, you're big stiff, you never were any good. He's 6'9". And he wasn't a starter or anything. And so in retirement, he put out a challenge. Let's go out to play one-on-one. And destroyed these guys.
Well, when I traded in the OEX pit, of course, those guys were all sports experts. Just ask them, they tell you. And they would talk about this guy sucks, that guy sucks on the Bulls. And I go, guys, I play. First of all, I said, look, you guys, you don't. I was, it didn't have to be nice in the pit. I go, you guys don't play anything. I'm still playing four nights a week. I said, and I'm going to tell you, the best guy I've ever played against is nowhere near as good as the worst guy who's ever played in the NBA, and I've played against some pretty good people. They looked at me like I had three heads. Well, there was a guy on the Bulls, I don't know if he didn't make the playoff team one year or the other, but if I knew the name, you'd remember him. Big black guy, 6'10 or something. Well, after he retired, he's playing in a couple of these Southside leagues. The only reason, why, the only way they'd let him in is if he promised not to score. I mean, that's how much better these guys are. It's like somebody who's a pretty good golfer going out and playing a pro and thinking you're almost as good. What are you, out of your mind?
Well, let me give one more thing, and it comes from the Midwest. But I was a gym rat too. I used to play at the Y all the time, and we had NBA players that come there. Rick Mahorn, Michael Adams were both from.
Well, Rick Mahorn, he had to be a big dude.
Oh yeah, he was huge, and he was a nice guy. I remember one time I was all roused up and playing pretty good, and he grabbed my arm and held me down while he got the rebound, just smiled at me like, you think you're doing something? How do you like it if I hold you down on the ground? But the point of my quick story was, there was a guy about 6'4", kind of slender, maybe 185 pounds, and he was just slicing and dicing through us game after game. And I said to somebody, who the hell is that? And they said, oh, that's Jerry Fort, number one draft pick of the Boston Celtics 2 years ago, all-time leading scorer at the University of Nebraska. And I thought to myself, and this is not a unique situation at these big city Ys, you see guys there that got all the way up, all-time leading scorer at a major university, and he's gone from the pros.
Yeah, it's well, if somebody, I mean, we got a lot of other stuff to talk about. When I was a freshman, Joe Theismann was a senior, right, and he's playing quarterback, and he's, you know, he might have been 6 foot, you know, he had, you know, like maybe 6 foot, a half inch. And how good you have to be to play quarterback in the NFL at that height? Well, in a basketball court, first the guy had a body. He looked like Kirk Douglas. I mean, he was absolutely ripped. And on a basketball court, I never saw a guy that had footwork like that. He'd be standing there, and all of a sudden he'd be 4 feet to the left, and he didn't even see him move. I mean, you can see why a guy like that could play pro ball with some big, huge lineman in front of him. All of a sudden he wasn't in front of him. The guy had footwork that was like a blur. And that's not normal. People aren't like that. It's very, very rare. We had a guy named Steve Niehaus. You know, you remember this story. He was a freshman. He was the first year a freshman could play football. And he started out with 2-3 huge games. Sports Illustrated was going to put him on the cover of the magazine. He went from there to a pass rushing drill and hurt his knee. Right, so he was out for his freshman year, so he never got on the front page. But you'd go to the saloon where everybody's playing pool, and you'd see this big, bulky guy walking around the table like he was a ballet dancer. He looked like Jackie Gleason in The Hustler. What did Paul Newman say? Look at him. He looks like a ballet dancer. You think he's a big guy. He's light on his feet. This guy, you saw him walk, he walked different than people. I mean, there's something in the genes that we didn't have. We had the genes we wanted to play, but we weren't there. You were closer than me, but we enjoyed it anyway, right?
Oh, we had a blast.
All right, so what's up in the world? I don't want to dive into our president a little bit, but what is going on with this blast of the survivors, and then the president yesterday saying, well, they were bad people anyway. Does he realize he's supposed to be the moral compass of us, or does he have any idea what he's talking about?
Well, if he's the moral compass for us, we're all in trouble.
I would say so.
Well, basically, it's that they're violating all sorts of U.S. law, international law, uniform code of military justice, and now even, you know, Republicans in the Congress are growing tired of this Pete Hegseth, the guy whose only claim to fame was being on a weekend anchor on Fox and Friends, and also was thrown out of the National Guard for having white supremacist tattoos. A lot of people don't know that. I think right now, with Trump and Hegseth trying to blame the military people for the decision, it's not going to turn out too well. I think the military guys are going to be forced to tell the truth at some point in time. But as far as Hegseth, I think he's looking at maybe if it gets too bad for politically for Trump, I think Hegseth could be the first one tossed out of the Trump cabinet.
What? If you don't want to go here, let's not go here. But how much of what? I mean, my guys accused me of not being in the middle, but I just look at people on both sides. I listen to what Trump says, and I'm appalled. I listen to what my mayor says here, I'm equally appalled. So I don't know if that puts me in the middle or what it does, but I'm sensing a power growth in his own mind that is seeming to me to be very racially biased. Where I mean, it's, you know, the idea that, well, these people are from Venezuela, we think they're guilty, they're bad people, people here are being hurt, so what?
And all Somalis are bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very, if you're not like me, there's something wrong here, and that plays to some people, especially in an economy where not everybody is doing so well. The idea that these people are here sucking up on this, on all the, you know, the welfare and all that kind of stuff, which isn't true, by the way, but it's good video. How many people are going to go with this for a while, but then they're going to go, wait a minute, it's a little too far. My problem with Trump really is not so much with him, it's with the people that believe this stuff. And I thought we were doing better as an educated population than it looks like we are, and that's my real disappointment with this, is nobody seems to want to dig in and find the truth. And I don't know, my disappointment is not with him. There's always going to be somebody like him. Well, maybe not quite like him, but the idea that he's believed and people will go with this. I mean, I'm stunned that he got away with the one with the Saudi guy, with the guy they dismembered. We didn't like that guy anyway. You know, basically shit happens. I mean, he said that on national TV. I'm going, wait a minute. Where did that go ahead, Andrew? Sorry.
Well, no, I didn't mean to jump in, but you'd said it's appalling that people would go along with it. Well, they did go along with it, but I was just going to say there's new polling that he's more than 20 points underwater on the immigration issue in terms of the public. And so maybe people were on board with it when it was big abstractions, but when you have mass men on the streets and it's coming out, the huge bonuses they're making, there's reporting that some of these people might be making $200,000 a year, the guys in the mass rounding people up, because they're getting overtime bonuses. We don't know who they are. The public, I think, is gradually more and more coming to the view, we're finding out what it's actually like to have mass people in camouflage and guns taking people hither and there off our streets. We don't like it.
Andrew, do you have any idea? Sorry, maybe, or maybe Wayne. The two points of view, one of which I am. One is, you know, we've had a couple of guys on the show say, well, these guys are DEA people. There's a 4-month training program somewhere. They really are trained for this, blah blah blah. And then there's the other point of view from somebody else who was on the show a few weeks ago, is they're a bunch of Proud Boys you yanked out of a trailer, gave them a $50,000 bonus, put a mask on them, and say you go beat up people. I mean, the commercial here.
I think it's we don't know. That's the
problem. My point. I was asking you, who the hell are they?
We don't even know if they themselves are U.S. citizens. You know, Eric Prince, who founded Blackwater, and who's, you know, sister was Trump's education secretary in the first administration, Betsy DeVos. He for years has advocated using mercenaries like his Blackwater guys to replace a lot of U.S. military and law enforcement personnel. Now, isn't it funny? We haven't seen or heard much of Eric Prince, and you know, I think that's a problem. When you don't hear or see these guys, they're up to something. And so could these guys even be from like foreign countries that have human rights issues, like Colombia or El Salvador. We don't know, because some of these guys, even though they're masks, they speak Spanish, because that's what they do when they spot somebody. Well, you know, they could be Americans, but perhaps not.
Yeah, we don't know much of, you know, Proud Boys are not necessarily linguists in college before they join. And one important point, since the show is stocks and jacks, is we have the names of some of these people. Wayne just mentioned Eric Prince, Betsy DeVos, education secretary. And of course, there's Steve Witkoff, who's negotiating with Russia. Well, you dig down deeper, these people are immensely wealthy, immensely. And so it's not just, oh, he founded this, Eric Prince, Blackwater, it had to keep changing its name because it was so nefarious. But they come from a huge fortune in Michigan. And there's just been a reporting on Witkoff has got hundreds of millions of dollars in pending deals with Russian oligarchs, and he's supposedly negotiating on behalf of the
U.S. I've been hearing every rumor like that, Andrew. That's why I was dying to talk to you guys this week. We missed you last week. Part of this negotiation seems to be the spoils afterward.
Yeah. Well, yeah, they're talking about, well, there's $300 billion in frozen Russian assets, and one of the quickest ways to end the war would be just to start moving that to Ukraine and tell Russia, look, the train's moving on your $300 billion in assets. But this peace deal seems to plant, so-called peace deal, seems in part to divide the $300 billion between the U.S. and Russia. And the U.S. often in these situations means the Trump family and its cronies.
Why do I get this really horrible feeling that this peace deal is going to start a war, not end one?
Well, that's what the Europeans now feel. There was a meeting with Zelensky the other day, it may have been in Brussels or Paris, but all the key European countries and organizations were there, EU, NATO. The United States did not have a representative present at that meeting, so that indicates that Europe is and as far as what we hear from European leaders, they're saying, look, the issue is Putin and Russia. He's intending to take Ukraine and keep marching west into the Baltics, Poland, and Finland, Sweden, and other countries, Romania. And I think there's going to be a war, but we're not going to be in it. We're going to be like one of the countries in World War II that remained neutral, like Juan Perón's Argentina or Franco's Spain, and say, well, we don't care who wins this thing. We just want to look out for ourselves.
I think most people here, other than maybe the White House that has deals, really doesn't want Russia to win.
Yeah, that's true, and the polling shows that. And if we're to believe statements from Republicans in Congress, many of them don't believe it either. Now there's a few.
Well, how do you have a guy who goes in, invades another place? Now, whether he thinks in his own mind, you know, that it's their place, and whether McCain went over and, you know, went over his shoes by telling people to get into NATO, whatever little jabs might have happened. The fact is, some guy invaded another place, kidnapped a whole bunch of kids, wiped out a bunch of hospitals and schools and everything else, and killed a load of people. The 28-point peace plan gives everybody a get-out-of-jail-free card. How do you do that?
Yeah, and gives Russia not only the land it's already occupying, but land that the Ukrainians fought to gain back. If Russia gets this land, it puts Russia within easy striking distance of Odessa, which would be Ukraine's only port on the Black Sea, but that would let them go into Moldova and into Romania and expand. And of course, this idiot in Hungary, this fascist Orban, Trump's friend, he's looking at grabbing some Ukrainian land for Hungary that he claims belonged to Hungary way back when Hungary was an ally of Hitler. So,
how many people in this country know that the entire middle part of the U.S. technically belongs to Spain?
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, well, a lot of people were concerned that when Trump met Putin in Alaska, that he was going to give Alaska back to the Russians.
I don't. This whole idea that somebody thinks that all this is his to give, I never thought we'd. You know, last night I wake up after watching one of these great games. I fall asleep on. I'm sitting there. You know what I got to ask these two guys? If at the end of this term, are we going to have, assuming he leaves, are we going to have a constitutional convention? Because I mean, the Constitution was written with a lot of powers to the federal or the executive side, thinking George Washington was going to be president, not this guy. I mean, is there no limit to pardons? Yeah. Is there no limit to declaring war on people? I mean, the whole idea that only Congress can declare war—that one's out. That one's out somebody's ass. How many pardons can you give? 1,000?
Well, let me jump in on that. It seems like an easy solution, but it's actually extremely dangerous a bad idea. Sorry, I know it's not your idea. You're posing the questions. There's a much simpler fix for people who think we got a big problem, and that's simply to expand the size of the Supreme Court in keeping with historical precedent, expand it from 9 to 13, because the number of circuits has gone from 9 to 13, and a Supreme Court that actually follows precedent and the law would solve most of the problems that a Constitution convention would solve. But once you open up a Constitution convention, you don't know what's going to happen, and it's probably not good. Whereas just appointing four more justices to the Supreme Court that follow the law, that's simple.
Well, I mean, I hear you, and by the way, I would not be lobbying for that. That's why I asked my two knowledgeable friends. But simple stuff. It says in there, well, you know, only Congress can declare war. Well, guess what? This guy's killing people all over the world and says it's okay, and he can do it on his own. Okay, now, he's not the first to have done that, by the way, but it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse.
Same thing with tariffs.
Well, it also said, you know, that an executive can give part. Now, why that was in there, Andrew, our attorney guy, might be able to go through what they were talking about at the Continental Congress or whatever it was, or the Constitutional Convention, the original one. I mean, does that mean anybody who gets convicted you like or thinks you might support when you get them out? Can you give 1,000?
And here's a very important point, I think, that's often lost, and I often omit it myself, so I'm saying this to remind myself. But the simplistic heritage of our Constitution is it's all people with wigs, three-cornered hats, and muskets in the 1700s that created it. But it's very important, particularly for anybody from Illinois, like us, two of us on this call, to remember that a vital part of the Constitution are the Civil War amendments that were created after the Civil War, you know, with Lincoln leading a revised view that Congress implemented in the 14th and 15th Amendment, due process, very important. And that's not from the 1790s, that's from the 1860s, and it's part of the Constitution, and it answers some of the questions you've raised.
Well, let's go to a quick break, guys, because I want to dig in a little more. We're going to test Andrew's knowledge of What are all the notes that people made in the, when you look at the Constitution, what do people always refer to, Andrew, in the, they say, well, here's the debate the day before this one went in there. What are those things called? The constitutional papers or something?
The Federalist Papers. And
anyway, well, SP Futures up 5, NASDAQ Futures down 6. Going to a quick break because not much is going on. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks. Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here. Right now.
Hello and welcome back, Stocks and Jacks. I'm Tom Howe, Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 3, NASDAQ Futures down 17. We're going to go through this pretty quick because not much is happening. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX up 206. That's up 0.9%, so that's a happening thing. FTSE only up 14.1%. The CAC round up 37. So they were not that bullish yesterday, but they are today because we were up yesterday. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei up 1,100 points. It's 2%. That's kind of a lot. Again, this rate cut hope fueled by weak jobs data. I'm going to talk to our guys when I'm done with this. This idea, I've never liked this period of time, and we've had it a few times in my lifetime, where bad news is good news, is good news is bad news. I think that's really bad, but that's just me. Hang Seng up 175.7%. Shanghai down 2%. Let's call that flat. Bonds. These guys rates have been up a little bit, and they're up again today. 0.05%. We're up to 4.10 on the 10-year. Now, it's nowhere near 5, but it's back above the 4 number. The blend up 2 base points, 2.77. Oil, which can't seem to go anywhere, it's up 39 cents, 59.34. Boy, I'm glad I'm not trading oil. Yikes. Brent up 34 cents, 63.01. Natural gas unchanged, $5 even. Gold down 10 bucks, 42.22. Silver down 76 cents. Silver's been very volatile, 57.85. Foreign exchange. Now, this. Dow is down for the dollar is down for the 10th straight day, a little bit though. 116.6 on the euro. It's very slight movement. Same thing with the British pound. Very, very slight. 133. It's down like 0.001. So it's down, but only in headline terms. Bitcoin down 168.92.923, way above from the 80,000 below it put in. What do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right. It is 7:34 here in Chicago on Thursday, December 4th. Just a little bit of sports here. The Bulls lost to the Nets, ending 113-103. For Chicago weather, it's going to be a very cold one today. It's currently 12 degrees. We're going to have a high of 19. Hopefully that gets a little better throughout the day, but we'll see. It is going to be some sunshine, but I don't think that's going to help the temperature much. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 44 degrees. They're going to have a high of 67. They're going to have sunny skies as well. And finally, for Chicago traffic, they're no major accidents to report, but things are heavy on all the inbound expressways and on the outbound if you're on the on the Kennedy. Average inbound times for taking the whole highway is going to be about 50 to 60 minutes, basically for every single inbound expressway to the Jane Byrne. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Guys, I know and thank you for hanging with me as I seemingly jump from topic to topic, but in my weirdo mind, it's kind of the same topic because it seems like we're questioning everything that we have known for the last 40, 50 years. I mean, with Lou, we were talking about we're questioning amateur athletics. I mean, where are we going? We're well on our way. We have no destination in mind. And I just keep dropping back to, we also talked earlier about defined profit. you know, should Northwestern be able to pay people a gazillion dollars in his massive cash flow and not pay any property taxes when they own a square mile, for God's sake? The same thing with the pardon stuff. And I know I'm with you, Andrew, on a constitutional convention is probably not a great idea. But I want to know why you, I don't know if you remember, but one day you informed us that the big difference in our Constitution between all the stuff in Europe is the judiciary was an independent area. Now, having done that, if we're sitting in this convention back in 17-something, what is the motivation, what were we thinking when we gave the executive branch the ability to pardon somebody? In their mind, going back, how the hell do we know what's in their mind 200-some years ago? In their mind, why was that necessary, and what do you think they meant by it?
Well, I once attended a very interesting discussion on this at the very conservative Heritage Foundation here in D.C., and they talked about this history and the increasing difficulty of using the pardon power. The Republican governor of Maryland was talking about that. But I think to answer your question more directly, it comes out of common law of the Middle Ages, England, the concept that sometimes a situation is so necessary that you need the king, or in our case, the chief political officer, the governor or the president, to just cut through the red tape and provide justice in a way that a parliament or elected people can't do. And a great example in a positive way that has a Chicago and historical roots is that on the very first day that President Biden gave anyone pardons, he pardoned Abraham Bolden, a Chicago resident, who was the very first African-American state policeman in Illinois history.
Well, I remember this story. We talked about it.
Oh, yeah. And he had been a whistleblower as a Secret Service officer, was framed and imprisoned, and Biden just cut through it to pardon him.
He was also dead. He was already dead, right?
No, he's still alive.
Okay, he's up there, though. I mean, he's...
Oh, yeah, he's getting close to 90. But at any rate, the concept is that the chief executive does justice. But what it's not supposed to be is people who contribute money to the chief executive, or he thinks their type of gross criminality of drug trafficking, defrauding billions of dollars from ordinary people, that he just decides to give him because he likes him. And that's what we're increasingly seeing. And that is an argument for maybe not a constitutional convention, but maybe a targeted amendment. But you don't want to open up the whole thing because we don't know who would attend this.
Well, that's
constitutional
right.
Convention. But
as you know, I'm no fan of Blagojevich, yeah. But the whole thing with him, I thought, was the absolute railroading from God knows where, and the guy had no business in jail for 14 years. So commuting that sentence, I mean, I commend the president.
Yeah.
If an asteroid were to drop on one of our heads today and we end up, if there is a heaven, and we walk up to Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, I think he was there. Hey, guys, in your wildest of dreams, how many times per year do you think the president would use his pardon thing? What do you think the answer would be? I think it'd be like twice.
Well, if that were me, I think I'd be asking Ben Franklin some stories about his time in Paris.
Well, wait. Wayne knows how to get to the interesting parts.
I understand Wayne a lot more than now that I went to Ole. Now I know he went to Ole Miss.
By the way, I was about to say something, but it's much more interesting to talk about Wayne and his adventures. Wayne, this last week came out with two books, and that's partly why he's up in D.C. now. And maybe we can encourage him to talk about at least one, because it involves exactly these kinds of activities. But and then maybe he can talk in a more serious way about his studies at Navy ROTC at Ole Miss, where he learned about in a very careful course. He was telling me about that you do not obey unlawful commands. So,
we had a lot of required reading. We had to do basically like book reports. One of the books we had to read was The Kane Mutiny, the idea is, even though that was fiction, that you know, the commanding officer, if you saw the movie, that was Humphrey Bogart, Captain Queeg, was wrong. And there are times when you do not obey orders from somebody in the chain of command. We also had to read about the My Lai massacre and how William Calley and people in that chain of command were wrong and that they committed a war crime when they massacred those civilians at that South Vietnamese village. So this was ingrained in us. I'm now hearing that it's still taught at the Naval Academy, this sort of curriculum on illegal orders and not obeying them. Now it just seems like this administration wants to change all that and throw it out with a lot of other stuff that's being thrown out in public schools and colleges and universities. But this is a dangerous path. We also studied the Nuremberg case. We studied.
I was just going to ask you. Think these guys even know the name Nuremberg?
No, and we were basically told that Harry Truman was absolutely right in firing Douglas MacArthur for not obeying an order from the commander in chief. So that was my curriculum, and it was I'm sure every naval ROTC unit from Ole Miss to Notre Dame to the other ones where they hadn't been thrown off of the campuses during the protest movement, but and also at the Naval Academy.
There was a guy, I happened to stumble across this thing on YouTube, and they had three or four people talking about this boat incident as to whether or not, you know, there were survivors clinging to the thing. You know, Trump claims, you know, that they just blew the boat up, and if with the implication where if they'd have been far enough away on a life raft, they wouldn't have been blown up or some crazy stuff. But the one guy who was actually a retired, I don't know, he was a captain or whatever he was, admiral, he said not only is this so clear, he said if you look at the rules of engagement, he goes, the exact example that they use is you sunk a ship and there's survivors there, you can't go blast the advice. He goes, that's the exact example in the code of military or whatever it is. Is that true?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. One of the reasons I've always wanted to go to Lisbon, Portugal, and it's been on my bucket list, and maybe the final thing on my bucket list the older I get. My dad sailed in the Merchant Marine during World War II. He was in the Danish Merchant Marine because he was from Copenhagen, but then when Germans invaded, he was in the British and finally in the American Merchant Marine. But they happened upon one time a bunch of Germans in a lifeboat, and they, you know, threw over the Jacob's ladder, and the German captain of the sunken ship tried to climb up, and my father, who was the radio officer navigator, he said his captain said, no, you don't come anywhere near the deck of this vessel. They gave him some water, they gave him some food, and then my father radioed the nearest British communication station, said, hey, there's a bunch of guys, I think they were off of a U-boat.
Yeah, they would have to have been, I would think.
And And so the British came and nabbed them, put them in a POW camp for the rest of the war. So when my father's ship pulled into Lisbon, apparently the word had gotten out what they had done. You know, the idea the Germans said they should have taken them to the closest neutral port, which would have been Lisbon. And the German consul in Lisbon came on their ship and demanded to see the captain, which he did, and he started haranguing him. The captain of my father's ship grabbed the guy by the seat of his pants and his collar and threw him overboard into Lisbon Harbor. Now, I'm thinking that there must be some record of this diplomatic incident somewhere in the archives in Lisbon, and that's one of the reasons I've always wanted to go there.
Wait, did the merchant marine people, were they like, well, like my uncle was in some kind of a construction group over in Honolulu. He wasn't in the army. He did something in ship repair, but he got no GI Bill. Merchant marine people get any of that stuff or no?
Yeah. It was later, not in the beginning, but they tried to rectify that because a lot of merchant marine were lost, of course, in the convoys that delivered arms and ammunition to Murmansk in the Soviet Union. A lot of people went down, and my father talked about several times where they narrowly avoided being torpedoed, including in the Pacific by the Japanese. But after I think it was basically maybe in the early 80s, this might have happened under Reagan, that they decided to give merchant marine some veteran status, maybe not the full Monty, but that they would get.
What exactly does that mean, merchant marine?
Well, it goes back to the days when merchant vessels would put cannon on board because they were prey to other countries' navies or pirates, and so the merchant marine started out as if you were in peacetime, of course, they were civilian vessels, and in wartime, they would become basically combatant vessels, and in many cases, they were, of course, accompanied by U.S. Navy and Coast Guard.
Well, so if somebody spits out a brand new Liberty ship, which they did like every day,
yeah,
and somebody says, I guess we'll have to make him the captain. He was in the Navy, right, Andrew? You three idiots. We'll give you three other guys, and you take this little Liberty ship over, and it's got a bunch of tanks on it, and maybe some Marines, and maybe not, or maybe just bullets. What are we exactly? We're not in the Navy. Well, you were, but I mean, what are the rest of us?
For example, I noticed my father had ribbons that were awarded by back then it was the War Department, and it is apparently again. They also, if they were taken prisoner, they were to be treated like any other military person.
But did Andrew and I draw a paycheck from the Navy or from the company that was running the thing or what?
There was during the war, there was a war shipping administration, which was heavily populated by military people, and that came under the Maritime Administration, which had always existed to basically run our merchant ships. Now, when I was in the Navy, I was stationed in Coos Bay, Oregon, which was a major merchant port, and my collateral duty was naval control of shipping officer, in the event of war, I was supposed to go down to these merchant ships and organize convoys. Now, we did exercises where they were paper revolutions, but that was one of my collateral.
This is when? This is in the 70s?
Yeah, in the early 80s. Yeah.
Okay. Hey, guys, let's kind of switch a little bit, since we are Stacks and Jacks. I'm going to use the term revolution apparently going on in the Federal Reserve. I don't think, I think this is true, that even though Powell is out as the chairman come May, he still has two more years to run. I don't think he has any intention of it, but he could stay, which would deprive Trump of a spot, which means he'd have to pick the new chairman from the committee itself, correct? Rather than bringing in this, was it Bessent? Who's the guy he's bringing in?
Hassett.
I absolutely can't, you know, I don't know the man, so I shouldn't say anything bad, but I... he looks to me like my brother said he... Remember the movie The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance and the one stooge that whenever Liberty said something, the guy would laugh? He was like his token laughing guy. This guy reminds me of that. Why is that? Anyway, but now, if he's going to come in and just drive interest rates to 2% and make us the Weimar Republic, and everybody who has owned stuff is just going to be able to pay their mortgage off in new money and be wealthy for the next 500 years in this country, if that's the plan, is that the plan? I mean, what are we doing here? I mean, we've spent so much time in the last week or two. I mean, Hal got us on this regarding the banking laws and Greenspan's little thing about reserve requirements. And since we've gone from, boy, I've taken you guys a whole different way here. Since we've gone from reserve requirements to capital requirements on banks, and we have the Dodd-Frank piece of legislation, which could be the worst ever in our lifetime, we've made it so we only give loans to people that, well, I won't say don't need it, but the people who are, you know, the big people, and how the capital requirements are so much different in $100 million to Amazon than it is if it's $5 million to 20 Andrew and Wayne plumbing companies. And I don't know why we ever did, well, I guess I do know why we did that, but whoever the we is, but is, where are we going with this? Is the Federal Reserve no longer going to be independent, assuming they ever were? Where does this play out?
Well, can I jump in quickly on that? It happens that Paul Krugman's column today, this morning, former New York Times kind of economic columnist, his title is Eggs, Lies, and Gasoline, The Unbearable Lightweightedness of Being Kevin Hassett. And even though you pose it, Chief, in terms of a question, Krugman goes to Hassett's interview on CBS Face the Nation Sunday, where he says that gasoline is under $2 in parts of the U.S. And Krugman's column basically says that's an amazing comment that the CBS interviewer barely picked up on, but there's nowhere where gasoline is under $2 a gallon, and that means that either Hassett is lying on nationwide TV about an obvious fact, or he doesn't know. And either way, we're in trouble.
Well, I just wrote a thing. I should forward it to you guys, to the rest of the Stacks and Jacks group. And, this is, I guess, my little corner of expertise is on inflation because of where I went to school and what I did when I first came out of school. And the issue here, because Hal was talking about how if you take the weeklies and the money supply, he was exponentially putting it out that next year or year after it was on a trip toward 11%. And now it's kind of backed off of that a little bit. And the idea that, money is inflation is always a monetary phenomenon is burned into me from my years at the University of Chicago. But the idea, what we're fighting here is something kind of really unusual, and I'd like your guys' opinion on this because that's what I just wrote to everybody, is we have an issue from a few years ago where in an 18-month period we increased the money supply by 40%. Under two presidents, both of whom I think were totally incompetent. Now, that has nothing to do with anything, but we allowed that to happen because we wanted to send out checks to people, even though because nobody was working. All right, but we didn't tax or borrow the money, we just printed it. All right, so here we got all this money flying around. And I think the inflation bubble at the time was probably, over the year and a half, was probably in the 30 to 40% range. Let's say 35%, even though our people say it was 18 or 15 or 20 or something. I think it's double that. Well, now we have this bubble. Now, you would think that when the crisis was over, the Fed would probably pull some of this money back. But it ran the market up and some asset prices up to where the people who own this stuff going, wait a minute, we like it right where it is. And so we're not going to do that. The same thing we did in 2001. We pulled back, and it caused those dot bombs to go flying down. We don't want to do that again. So right now, whether the inflation going forward, like he mentioned, by the way, gas is under 3 around here in a few spots, which is lower than it's been in really 3-4 years. But that's the only price you really look at. But you've got people that have no way have gotten a 35% raise in the last 4 years. So the bubble is still there. And whether we're 3% or 2% or 4% going forward really doesn't even matter compared to it, it's almost like if you guys have to pay $10 to park in front of your house, and all of a sudden they go, wait a minute, due to budgetary constraints, it's now $1,000. And now for the next 5 years, it doesn't go up at all. Okay, the inflation going forward is 0, but you're still stuck, right? I think that's kind of where we are. Am I totally wrong?
No. I mean, but by the way, Andy and I this morning are going to be at a conference at the Willard Hotel where Jamison Greer, the U.S. Trade Representative, is going to be. If there's anything you would like to pass on to him.
Well, I mean, it has to do with, it's almost like the old stock and flow analysis.
Yeah.
I mean, right now people think they're okay just hoping her car doesn't break, because God knows the transmission is $5,000 now, or you don't need a roof that's $40,000. The whether or not chicken or gas comes down tomorrow has nothing to do with any of this, which is makes it even more bizarre. The guy said that on national TV.
And now it's being generally, it's from what I'm hearing, it's not whether there's an AI bubble or not. It's there is one, but you know, how big is it, and you know, when it pops, how much damage there will be.
Why are you guys, I mean, I know you're more involved in this economics than you let on to believe. Are you as, I don't know, all the time in my 40 years doing this, I found it difficult to trade, although I'm getting a lot better at that because I look at the news more than I used to. This idea of good news versus bad news for the market, where if all of a sudden we came out tomorrow and said we laid off 8 million people, like the market would be up 10% because that means we're going to throw more money at the system and turn ourselves into Weimar Germany. I have a real problem with that. Do you guys, I think you understand what I'm talking about, but...
Oh, yeah. No, and then it may be good for... Who was that guy, Chainsaw Al, 20 years ago?
Hexoil. Yeah. He was from Sunbeam, remember?
Yeah. And you come in and you sell everything off, and it's a short-term gain for somebody, but you leave chaos in the wake.
Neutron Jack Welch at General Electric had the same reputation.
How'd that work out?
Good in the short term, not so good a little bit later. And so I think I often think about you having to advise clients. Very, very difficult, because you've got to be worried about a longer term. But people see the market going up this year, and yet you looking out for people's interests, you got to be saying, "Be careful."
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you have. It is very difficult. Matter of fact, we've got a couple new clients. It seems, guys, that the people we're getting now, I mean, we get, you know, a lot of different kinds, but the lion's share, you know, are my skill set and the people around. We're one of the few that actually will deal with, I'll use the term, a concentration issue. You know, or if Wayne was lucky enough to buy, you know, Apple for the last 20 years, and all of a sudden he's got $10 million, and by the way, 9.9 million of it's an Apple. All right, so that's terrific for Wayne. I'm proud he did that. But now all of a sudden, a one-stock portfolio is, you know, it's good if the stock goes up. It's not so good if it goes the other way. And stocks tend to not, you know, do 30 years where they're on top of the heap. Now the question is, what do you do with it? I mean, I happen to think with this guy coming in as the Fed chair that we might see a little more appreciation in the market, yet... It wouldn't take much, either on the international scale or the war scale or something. You know, I think some of these stocks are 40% overvalued. So my job would be to protect this for Wayne without charging an arm and a leg by buying puts every other day, or doing something on the call side that, that sort of allays the put cost, put being insurance, without really truncating his upside all that much, or else why do you want to keep it? So yeah, it's a very imaginative way to go about it, and it's actually very difficult. And I don't know how anybody could try and do it on themselves. I mean, it's like me trying to be a plumber by myself. Why would I ever do that? That would be leaking all over the damn place. I mean, I think, Andrew, you have a pretty good sense of right now when you think things are a little overvalued, but you think they might go higher because of the politics. It's a tough spot.
Well, I feel for you. And maybe two kind of quick points. Since we're doing things verbally here, in the Krugman column, he recognizes, as you just did, that gas in some spaces is under $3. He was talking about it's not under $2.
Right. Oh, yeah. What's that?
And Hassett should know that. The other thing, quick point, and I think it's related, is the reason he entitled his column "Eggs, Lies, and Gasoline" is his view is that eggs and gasoline prices have very little to do realistically with who's president, or even who's head of the Fed, but there are other issues that are more complicated that you're just raising that the Fed has to be thinking about, that's more directly under their control, as you're pointing out.
Well, it's also, I mean, we got a dash here, guys. I could talk to you for all day, as you obviously know, but I mean, you look at the electric bills here, and you guys, you've fled Illinois, good for you. And Wayne fled Mississippi, it appears, too.
wasn't my home state, though. I'm still a Philadelphia guy.
You weren't tempted to stay there? I can't imagine you.
I got out of there one semester early by taking AP classes, just so I wouldn't have to do another 6 months in Mississippi.
Well, if you look at, of course, the advertisement, which Commonwealth Edison must be paying for, was how the electric bills are going up. I think it's gas, electric, but it could have been the other. It could be people's. What's the difference? It's the same thing. How they tried to get a $370 million hike, but the legislator did their job and they're only going to get half of that. So you should be happy it wasn't the 370. Now, the three of us, I think, are whatever we are. We're old or grumpy enough to say, well, they put out their 370 because so they'd be happy with half of it, and that's what they got. You know, that's would be. But if you look at your bill now, it has nothing to do with the price of natural gas or the price of atomic energy. It's 40 or 50 bucks is your charge just to be on the system. So if you and I went out and bought a generator and didn't use any electricity, it's still 40 or that's what's going up. It has nothing to do with the price of natural gas or oil or whatever they happen to be burning for this stuff. I mean, all these subtle changes that these monopolies can do. I mean, if the place I live in, there's four units. In the summertime, guess what? Except for the hot water heater, nobody cooks there. I mean, our natural gas use is like zero. And yet the bill's $200. It's $50 a piece for the unit. And that's what goes up. They don't care about the natural gas price anymore. So when somebody gets on there and says, well, look at the natural gas prices are lower because drill, baby, drill, so what? I mean, the detail here, which you guys like to dig into, is onerous almost, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, everywhere you look.
We're out of time, so I'll
just up. But you guys, as usual, terrific stuff. If Wayne is in Washington, I'm going to take the over, and you guys were in a bar last night.
Not last night because we were recovering from the night before,
which was a great night. You say just a quick, very quick 20-second thing. Wayne has published a book about bars in world capitals where spies, femme fatales, public officials, diplomats, and grifters like to go. And a dozen of them are in Washington. So we went to several of them, and Wayne's got the book under his arm, and of course the bartenders love it, and a good time was had.
Did you go to the Crow's Nest?
Not that one, but a couple others. So.
Isn't that the one in the Willard? Is that the Crow? Is that what they
no,
call
that's
it?
The Round Robin.
Oh, okay, the Round. Ooh, that had something to do with a bird.
That's where
okay.
we're going.
That's where we're, and that's where we'll be today, tonight.
Give me a toast on it. I was in there once, and guess who was sitting next to me? Your buddy Newt.
Oh.
He was,
we'll
you know,
give you a toast.
If ever was a guy who looked exactly in person like he does on TV, it's that guy.
Yeah.
You knew right away you looked at him, hey, that's Newt Gingrich. He looked exactly like he does on TV.
I've had a couple Gingrich encounters, which we'll talk about some other time.
All right,
not
guys.
On the air.
Okay. you guys have a good one. S&P Futures up 9, NASDAQ Futures up 16. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.